my position on money, just to put you straight on it, is I've always really been a social theorist, a sociologist, and money was just a sort of an excuse to look at certain things. And when I was working with Giddings at Cambridge, money really wasn't something that many sociologists were talking about or thinking about. Then there was a sort of explosion that came in 94. My book, Sociology of Money, was published. Viviana Zelis's book, Social Meaning of Money, was published. And then not long after that, the social studies of finance started taking root in about 2000. I remember the first couple of conferences where those guys were present. They were coming from the sociology of science anthropology. So that's kind of an interesting development. But I've always distinguished myself from the sociology of finance. I'm interested in money, I'm interested in currency, and I think that's a very different set of issues, actually, than finance. But that's maybe something we can talk about. This paper about Bitcoin, and I was debating actually before I came that maybe I should have put Bitcoin in the title, and there would have been hundreds of people would have turned up, because Bitcoin does that. We had a seminar in the LSE on Bitcoin, and people came in from everywhere, from the streets, and Bitcoin seems to give people mad staring eyes for reasons we'll discuss today. But anyway, the paper is intended eventually for a book that's been edited by Tom Kempel and Ollie Pittman about Zimmel, called The Anthem Companion to Zimmel, which is really an attempt to look at how Zimmel can be used in today's society. And so it seemed obvious to me to talk about Zimmel and the new forms of money that are coming around. And it seemed even more obvious to talk about Zimmel and Bitcoin. And so this is the first airing of this paper. It's been written freshly for this lecture, but I'll give it again in Pretoria in August, in Yale in September, and it will be published next year. So any comments, please bear that in mind, that you know you can be incorporated into the paper and you can help improve it, and that's what I'm really looking at. It's not a finished argument, it's a position that I'm taking on Bitcoin so far. Okay, let's start. Bitcoin has attracted widespread attention, encouraging doubts about the future of state money that are going mainstream, perhaps for the first time in the modern era. My interest in these debates concerns the connections that are being made between monetary reform and social reform. This is why I've embarked on a new project called Utopianism and the Future of Money. My argument is that almost all forms of money contain a utopian strain. By this I mean the belief that money, far from damaging society, as the classical social thinkers feared, can improve society. This is the context in which I am engaging with Bitcoin. I'll get used to this. There is nothing new about monetary utopianism. Money often features in utopian thought, albeit as much by its absence as by its reform. Nevertheless, these are interesting times for money. There are now several thousand alternative monetary systems in operation worldwide, using a range of different media and accounting schemes designed to foster local economic growth, resist financial exclusion, or challenge what many believe to be the persistent and damaging hegemony of states and banks in the way that money is produced and managed. And as this chart suggests, public interest in the nature of money is steadily increasing. This is just one of the Google trends. Despite the presence of several esteemed economists on the list of monetary reformists, Irving Fisher and Robert Shiller, for example, those who advocate fundamental changes to our monetary system are frequently dismissed as cranks. This quotation from John Kay, a strong advocate of narrow banking, so arguably a bit of a crank himself, typifies the genre. Personally, I prefer the term utopians to cranks. Monetary reform has been on the agenda for a long time. Many of the new projects that we see today are variations on much older schemes and themes. Since the early 1990s, however, there has been a surge of interest in the changing nature of money. The financial crisis appears to have fueled the enthusiasm of wider publics for new forms of money and credit, while also underlining the argument that the role of states and banks in money social production must undergo a fundamental transformation. As the Cypriot banking crisis erupted during the early months of 2013, the value of Bitcoin rose sharply against both the euro and the US dollar. There are many possible explanations for this, not least that we were witnessing a bubble. But the debates that have sprung up around Bitcoin phenomenon are revealing, because most of them are focused on the possibilities of developing a serious rival to mainstream currency. At a protest march in London during 2011, I wasn't carrying this banner, one cardboard placard captured a prevailing sentiment about money that seems to be driving renewed interest in its reform. The placard said, "We are the true currency." The words strike an intriguing counterpoint in the debate about banking reform, because they imply that the system can be reconfigured on a more human scale. They suggest, moreover, that money's value is derived from social life. The spirit behind the banner is captured, partially at least, by Zimmel's description of money as a claim upon society. More specifically, the phrase, "we are the true currency," suggests that money is not simply a claim upon society, but is social life, gaining its value not from the institutions that produce it, but from the people who use it. The sentiment nurtures the idea that money can play a crucial and constructive role in imagining and shaping alternative economic and financial futures. Money, in other words, is as much a solution to the problems of the banking crisis exposed as it was ever a cause. The question, my question is, where might Bitcoin fit into this? Let me present my core thesis in a few sentences. There is a paradox at the heart of the Bitcoin phenomenon. Bitcoin will succeed as money to the extent that it fails as an ideology. The currency relies on that which the ideology underpinning it seeks to deny, namely the dependence of money upon social relations and upon trust. Insofar as Bitcoin has been successful, it is because of the community that has grown up around it. Ironically, however, this community is sustained by the commonly held belief that Bitcoin has replaced social relations, the trust on which all forms of money depend, with machine code. This belief is a fiction. Bitcoin has thrived despite, not because of, its reliance upon machines. If ever there was a form of money that validates Zimmel's description of money as a claim upon society, it is Bitcoin, the very currency that was set up in denial of that very conception. Alternative monies typically involve two basic kinds of disintermediation, of money from banks and of money from the state. Some aim only for one of these, for example, sovereign money as envisaged by the Chicago Plan, which Irving Fisher was associated with, and most frequently positive money in the UK, and also Wohlgeld or something in Switzerland. There's a similar campaign. I think there's a campaign for this in many countries. It's basically reproducing the old arguments of Knapp, really. These aim at disconnecting money creation from banks. Hayek's proposals, on the other hand, for denationalising money, this goes back to the mid-1970s, and these have been echoed more recently by various proposals for monetary freedom or free market money. These aimed at disconnecting money production from the state. Bitcoin aims at both forms of disintermediation. But in this lecture, I want to argue that there is a fundamental and widespread confusion in relation to Bitcoin concerning its relationship to a third form of the mediation of money, namely its mediation by society or social life. This is because Bitcoin's ideology is about severing the relationship between money and trust. In order to explore what's wrong with the ideology behind Bitcoin, I want to turn to Zimmel. I'm not claiming that Zimmel provides a complete theory of money. Far from it. There may be other, more complete sociological theories of money. For example, the theory derived from Chartism, and Mitchell in his credit theory of money, which sees money essentially as a form of debt whose production has its own distinctive social structure. But for exploring Bitcoin, I believe that Zimmel's theory is more appropriate, not least because it focuses attention on two interconnected aspects of money that Bitcoin, as a theory and as an ideology, seek to deny. First, that money is intrinsically linked to human sociality, and second, that money is essentially a process, not a thing. The idea that money is a claim upon society is often read as a reference to the connection between money and the state. This is not correct. Zimmel didn't adhere to a nation-state or Durkheimian concept of society, but rather promoted an abstract philosophical idea of society as something abstract, more akin to a process, association, than an entity or thing. The relationship between money and society is a key problem in monetary scholarship. The notion of society that is generally used in relation to money needs to be more fluid. In Money in an Equal World, Keith Hart, a colleague of mine at the LSE these days, uses a differentiated concept of money in order to elaborate Zimmel's idea. He argues that society has three distinct senses within the sociological and anthropological literature on money: as state, as nation, and as community. Each concept of society yields a distinctive conception of money's social structure. As a creature of the state, money is a tool of power that expresses vertical relations between unequals, rulers and rules, like the top and bottom of two sides of the coin, heads and tails. As a token of community, money depends on trust and gets its value from horizontal relations between members of a community. Finally, as a symbol of the nation, money combines the formality of the state with the informal substance of community. Thus, for Hart, Zimmel's characterization of money as a claim upon society remains valid today, as long as the meaning of society is never fixed but allowed to flex according to the scale of the monetary form in question. As most of you will know, Zimmel preferred the concept of sociality as the focal point of sociology, which denotes an intermingling, a process of being social, as opposed to a state of belonging to society. This is what I sought to capture in my book when I refer to the social life of money. This more fluid conception of sociality might shed some light on some of the most significant and intriguing ways in which money is advancing beyond the state. What we have in mind here, though, is not an uber currency like the euro, but rather forms of money that are actively created by their users, such as arguably Bitcoin. This is why we need to go a bit further than Keith Hart. Although Hart rightly accepts that Zimmel's notion of society is never fixed, he nonetheless does fix it, albeit in three distinct ways. As helpful as this is as a typology, it misses important processual elements of Zimmel's position that turn out to be crucial for thinking about money. This is clear, for example, when one thinks of the theory of value from which Zimmel's conception of money is derived. Zimmel argues that just as society is made possible by the act of our being social, so is value. Value is not a property that belongs to an object like colour, taste or smell. It is a third category which stands, so to speak, between us and the object by virtue of a fluid interplay between subjects engaged in mutual sacrifice. Zimmel sought to understand how money brings an order to a world in which objects and values are in perpetual flux. This was perhaps the main source of his fascination with money, and the reason he wrote a philosophical investigation of its nature. He suggested that as a tool of mutual valuation, money represents the clearest embodiment of the formula of all being. This formula refers to the principle of relationism, which is the view that things receive their meaning only through contact with each other, while their mutual relations determine their being. In this regard, money is a process that provides Zimmel with a means to explore the epistemological implications of relationism. By following the money as it comes into contact with myriad people and things, he can explore the world just as he believes it is constituted, that is to say, as a process. Besides his emphasis on the sociality of money as a process, there is another reason for underlining the importance of Zimmel for understanding Bitcoin. He makes a strong substantive connection between money and utopianism. He does so in two important ways. First, epistemologically, Zimmel often characterizes money as a fiction. It rests on an idea of complete exchangeability that operates as what Weinheimer once called an as-if. When Zimmel talks of pure money, perfect money, or conceptually correct money, he's referring to an idea of money that no empirical form of money actually corresponds to, but which nevertheless plays a key role in shaping how various monies are constructed and used. Money in this sense bears a resemblance to a Weberian ideal type, or to a fiction in the sense used in Jens's work. Normatively is the second area in which Zimmel talks about money as a utopia. He considers money's connections, for example, with political ideals such as liberalism and socialism, but more interestingly, he develops a notion of perfect money that corresponds to the idea of the conceptually perfect society he outlines in How Is Society Possible? This would be a form of money that enables what he calls unequal pricing, and I explored this in that TCS article from a couple of years ago, Zimmel's Perfect Money. So, with all of this in mind, with that laid out, let's take Zimmel to M.T. Gox. And of course, M.T. Gox is rather a nice title for the place now, because of course, M.T. It is indeed empty. Bitcoin was launched, that was a weak joke, but that's I looked this morning, I woke up very early and I googled Bitcoin jokes, and I came to the conclusion that Bitcoin isn't funny. So I have no jokes. That is the closest I came to a joke. I do apologize. I've got lots of jokes, but they're not about Bitcoin. Bitcoin, and you don't want to hear them. Bitcoin was launched in January 2009 using open source software as a peer-to-peer payments network. Bitcoins are created within the network, and their creation is strictly controlled without being governed by a central issuing authority. The network is programmed to ensure that the total number of Bitcoins in existence will never exceed 21 million. Half of that total supply was generated by 2013. Bitcoins are created through dedicated rigs, PCs, which mine for new coins through a series of tasks that require considerable computational power. The network is designed to produce a fixed number of bitcoins per unit of time. 25 new bitcoins will be generated every 10 minutes until 2017, and that number will subsequently be halved every 4 years after that. The more people or rigs there are mining for coins, the harder they will be to produce. Now, only the most powerful rigs, i.e. several computers working together, look at that lot, are able to create new coins. Since its launch, the Bitcoin network has grown rapidly to become the most widely used alternative monetary system. I've got a list here, but I won't go through it because it will bore you, but you all know where you can use Bitcoin. I don't know if anybody here has ever used a Bitcoin or spent anything with a Bitcoin, but Silk Road is clearly the most notorious website where you can buy drugs and pornography, mostly. But that was closed down by the FBI last year, but Silk Road 2.0 opened a month later. I'm not quite sure what's happening to Silk Road now. I haven't used it, I have to confess. But anyway, that's the sort of thing that people do with Bitcoin, arguably. Now, during 2012, a rack of seven interconnected mining rigs was being advertised on YouTube.
The right choice.
Am I on the wrong? There you go. Right, perfect. During 2012, in July, a rack of seven interconnected mining rigs was being advertised on YouTube. And today's exchange rate of, hear this, $11.10 per Bitcoin. You can make over $850 a month with this setup, the ad claimed. I think today's exchange rate is $500 per Bitcoin, by the way. This claim gives one of the most crucial aspects of the Bitcoin phenomenon away. The rate had been more than $30 per Bitcoin a little more than a year earlier, before crashing in June 2011, and has been fluctuating ever since. The value of Bitcoins grew dramatically during late 2012 and early 2013, rising from $12 and topping out at $266 in April, before falling back to $130 in the face of apparent difficulties at M.T. Gox. That the currency's value rose dramatically again during late 2013, reaching a trading high of $1,242 by the end of November, before fluctuating wildly again, falling from $1,200 to $600 between December the 6th and the 7th. In 2013. Security breaches are among the major reasons most often cited for these periodic crashes. Another cause was that the very feature that was meant to ensure that bitcoins were sound money, just like gold, in the first place, their finite supply, became a source of speculation, a bubble. The total value of all bitcoins in the world exceeded $1 billion for the first time in March 2013. So, what makes Bitcoin different? Whereas it is usually up to institutions like central banks and the IMF to protect the value of money, Bitcoin delegates the task to machines. This makes it sociologically interesting and problematic, because the sociologists of science and technology will tell you machines never do anything quite by themselves. This is where the gulf opens up between the ideology behind Bitcoin and the practical reality of his operation. Public discourse about Bitcoin often focuses on the idea that this is money created out of nothing, virtual rather than real money. But as most monetary scholars will tell you, there's nothing at all unusual about this, and certainly nothing alarming. On the contrary, one of the most interesting things about Bitcoin is the material paraphernalia that supports it and the materialistic language that justifies it. Bill Maurer and his colleagues, for example, characterize the philosophy behind Bitcoin as a form of digital metalism that relies on the semiotics of metallic money with its language of mining and rigs and so on. It does indeed seem that Bitcoins are being dug up from the ground. It is the natural limits of supply that underpins the argument that gold should be money, of course, because its supply can't be artificially increased by governments or banks. As Maurer points out, it was this philosophy that led Locke to associate sound money with liberty because it emancipated money from government control. While the ideology behind Bitcoin is libertarian, the theory of money that informs it can be traced back to Menger, an image of money as a thing that must be kept scarce in order for its value to be protected, unites these phenomena. If money is a process, as Zimmel suggests, it seems that nothing could be farther from that idea than Bitcoin. So what is Bitcoin, sociologically speaking? In his lectures, Adorno used to define sociology as the investigation of the difference between what is the case in society and what society purports to be. In a similar vein, my argument today is that there is a gulf between what Bitcoin is claimed to be and what it actually is. According to Nakamoto, whoever he might have been, the root problem with most conventional forms of money is the trust that's required to make them work. The central bank must be trusted not to debase the currency, for example. Nakamoto's proposal sought to get rid of this central authority by using a blockchain shared by all computers or nodes within the network, through which the transaction history of each coin could be publicly known. Privacy would be maintained, meanwhile, by encrypting the public keys, ensuring that the history of every coin is anonymized. Most bitcoins are not really coins, of course. This is a ledger-based monetary system. Nakamoto's idea has been extraordinarily powerful, capturing the imagination of a wide range of people. At its heart are four very seductive ideas. First, the Bitcoin network is decentered and flat, with no hierarchy and no single point of authority. Second, Bitcoin offers fail-safe technological solutions to age-old problems of monetary governance, such as inflation. Third, Bitcoin dispenses with the need to trust others, whether they are experts, politicians, or ordinary people. And fourth, Bitcoin is debt-free, just like gold. In these four senses, one could describe Bitcoin as a utopia. There is a utopian strain in many forms of money linked to ideals such as individual freedom, community, national unity, social and economic justice. But what makes Bitcoin unusual, of course, is that it relies on technology to achieve these aims. Hence, I am calling it a techno-utopia. Whereas most monetary utopias are connected with social life in some way, the source of Bitcoin's attraction to its advocates seems to be that it bypasses social life. Bitcoin's underlying rationale is to ensure that money has anything but a social life. It is a technology of mistrust. And it is the ultimate symbol of a stateless existence, a form of money that no government can control. Here we have a direct contrast with Zimmel. Whereas his utopian understanding of money views money as a process that relies upon trust, that enables money to operate as a claim upon society, Bitcoin treats money as a thing whose reliance on complex technology enables it to dispense with trust, and therefore bypass society and social life insofar as they are the source of money's value. So let's scrutinize this image of Bitcoin as a flat network that replaces trust in society with technology. Is it true? Politically, Bitcoin certainly seems to be in tune with the times. For example, it resonates with the post-2008 Occupy movement. because it challenges the role of banks in creating money, but also due to its horizontalism. In this context, it is as a means more than an end that horizontalism matters. In his book on Occupy and the Arab Spring, the English journalist Paul Mason describes this in terms of the distinction between network and hierarchy. Social media such as Twitter epitomise a brave new world of the flat, horizontal network, governed not by central sources of authority or information, but by the wisdom of crowds. Likewise, David Graeber has drawn attention to horizontalism as one of the defining features of Occupy strategy. He also finds evidence of it in Argentina after the 2001 crisis, in which, as he points out, alternative currencies played a key role. Perhaps the ultimate financial expression of the wisdom of crowds is peer-to-peer lending, while the fast-growing sharing economy, couch surfing, for example, has taken the principle into the consumer world. Bitcoin seems to belong to this world, the only caveat being that Bitcoin automates the crowd. One is tempted to ask, what could possibly go wrong? In The Heretic's Guide to Global Finance, published in 2013, the financial activist Brett Scott argues that we should adopt a hacker ethos in the financial world, by which he means a creative use of extant financial tools in order to fulfill our own subversive ends. Horizontalism is an important aspect of this philosophy. Most interestingly, Scott argues that Bitcoin embodies a Rousseauian approach to finance, which can be contrasted to the old Hobbesian world of central banks. In other words, Bitcoin has replaced the sovereign with the general will. If it is true that Bitcoin has replaced Hobbes with Rousseau, it must follow that this general will has been abstracted from social networks and embedded in computer code. And this essentially seems to be the view taken by Bill Maurer, who argues that the sociality we would normally associate with trust has been embedded in computer code. If Maurer is right, it would be as if Zimmel's entire philosophy of social life had been automated, turned into software, or made into an app. I want to argue that this reading of Bitcoin as a horizontal network that embeds trust into computer code replicates the ideology behind it, but does not reflect the reality of Bitcoin's actual operation. As with all complex technical systems, social practices are crucial. Let me take two of the main arguments about Bitcoin in order to demonstrate this. The first is about its horizontalism. The second is about its social and sociological reality. Bitcoin has a strong flavour of DIY punkism, or punk DIYism about it. The idea of rigging up your own machine and creating your own currency. Besides Bitcoin, there is a whole host of other cryptocurrencies such as Dogecoin and Litecoin, offering variations on the theme, while guides are available that can even help you to create your own personal currency, the Dodcoin, for example. But in the case of Bitcoin especially, the argument for its horizontalism is undermined by the way the system incentivizes the most powerful producers of the currency to become even more powerful. Most of the Bitcoin mining is carried out through mining pools, which pull together multiple rigs in order to generate a block. Well, you might wait years to generate Bitcoin if you operate alone. By joining a pool, you stand a good chance of receiving fractions of Bitcoin on a regular basis. Reinforcing the incentives rewards a scale. The rewarded block is split according to processing power. As this graphic shows, relatively few powerful pools dominate Bitcoin mining. I almost joined a pool last night, but then I decided to go to bed. It is mathematically possible for one miner or mining pool with enormous processing power to monopolize the creation of new coins. Bitcoin would resemble the most hierarchical monetary system imaginable. Indeed, it would make most existing monetary systems wherein money is created through commercial bank lending look flat by comparison. Unsurprisingly then, the Bitcoin network has a discernible social structure, which is not altogether different from that which characterizes mainstream finance. Take this chart, which shows, rather awkwardly, the distribution of Bitcoin wealth among Bitcoin holders put together from survey data. The blue line meets 1% at the 50 Bitcoin mark, which means that you need roughly $28,000 worth of Bitcoin to become a 1%er. According to another survey, just 70 people, 70, own 30% of all Bitcoins in existence. There are something like 1 million owners of Bitcoin in total, so you're talking 70 out of 1 million owning 30%. This is a fairly high degree of concentration, although admittedly not as great as one finds with, say, the ownership of gold. Intriguingly, these asymmetries were being openly discussed, and critically so, at last week's Bitcoin conference in Amsterdam. I wasn't there, but I know that that's what they talked about. So much for horizontalism then, but Bitcoin is also characterized by an increasingly sophisticated degree of social organization. Take the case of Emmanuel Abiodun, who has a massive Bitcoin installation built in Iceland. This is it. In Iceland, because geothermal and hydroelectric energy are plentiful and cheap. Through which he generated more than $4 million worth of Bitcoins between October and December 2013. Abiodun runs a company called Cloud Hashing, which rents out computing power to people who want to mine without buying computers themselves. It costs $999 to rent a very small percentage of portion of the company's computing power for 1 year. So you heard it here first. Go and sign up. In response to such dynamics, more egalitarian Bitcoin enthusiasts have developed Bitcoin Script, which is committed to mining decentralization. This contrast between the dynamics of mining pools, where relative size is rewarded proportionately, versus mining decentralization is, of course, ideologically charged. So what looks like an apolitical technological utopia from a distance becomes socially nuanced and politically loaded once one starts looking at who is mining, where, with whom, and with what. This can also be seen when we look at the demographics behind Bitcoin. According to a survey conducted by Louis Smith, a PhD student and blogger in London, white men are hugely overrepresented amongst Bitcoiners, and I mean hugely overrepresented. Indeed, it seems something of a macho culture has arisen around Bitcoin. On the other hand, the political sympathies of Bitcoiners are varied. Smith's survey suggests that 25% are libertarian, 25% liberal, 25% more left-wing, with a few smaller groups of other political identities, such as anarchists. Contrary to expectations, then, Bitcoiners are not overwhelmingly libertarian, nor driven by greed. In fact, Smith argues that Bitcoiners are more likely members of the so-called precariat, whose economic existence is characterized by uncertainty and insecurity. Bitcoiners rarely talk about how many Bitcoins they have, says Smith. Instead, focusing on what they first heard, when they first heard about it, when they first got involved, and how they feel about the project. They do not talk about their stash as an asset, but rather as a shared interest. When the cruder financial implications are discussed, they're usually framed in terms of empowerment and escape. Calling Bitcoin horizontalist renders it sociologically anemic, buying into the ideology that is essentially is a machine. On the contrary, there is a strong sense of community around Bitcoin, as reflected in discussion groups, internet forums, and the organizations that are associated with it, and last week's conference, for example. In monetary terms, one could argue that the community around Bitcoin is still an important source of the disembedded trust that characterizes the currency itself. If anything, Bitcoin is not one techno-utopia, but it's myriad social utopias, because it appeals to a vast range of interests and concerns about the nature of money and, more broadly, its role in society. These, I would suggest, are a crucial factor in what nurtures and sustains Bitcoin, which in this particular sense is a social movement as much as it is a currency. But if Bitcoin is a social movement, what are its aims? Bitcoin could be seen as something of a protest currency. As suggested earlier, Bitcoin attracts many supporters because of dual disintermediation. It separates money from both banks and states. This resonates with two major axes of political debate about the relationship between finance and the state. One is quite obvious, the other somewhat less so. It seems obvious, to me at least, that much of Bitcoin's impact is due to the 2008 crisis. Public interest in Bitcoin resonates with debates about the nature of money and banking that were triggered by the 2008 crisis. For all their political diversity, Bitcoiners seem to unite around the common view that there are major problems with our existing monetary system, which require radical solutions, not piecemeal reform. This is the political conversation that sustains Bitcoin. Bitcoin therefore feeds on the same vein of discontent as positive money in the UK, which argues that banks should be deprived of their right to create money through lending. Much of this is related to the problematization of debt too. Like supporters of positive money and like gold bugs, Bitcoin appeals to those who regard debt as problematic morally, economically, and politically. Bitcoiners are not simply opposed to banks, though. Many of them also have major issues with the state. Arguably, this is Bitcoin's biggest source of public notoriety, fueled by Silk Road, the website through which one could buy drugs and pornography free from state regulation. This, I think, explains Bitcoin's role in a post-2001 world. Bitcoin could almost be a mirror image of the state's increasing use post-9/11 of the mainstream financial system for security purposes. And here I'm thinking of the work of people like De Goed in Amsterdam and Cooper in Australia. Bitcoin has attracted a barrage of criticism from sometimes hysterical media, perhaps reflecting its status as a protest currency. This criticism is usually advanced on two fronts. The first concerns Bitcoin's connections with crime. For example, the FT, the Financial Times, a regular critic of Bitcoin, characterises Bitcoin as the perfect monetary instrument for an anonymous community which has mutual interest in maintaining anonymity as well as an alternative underground store of value. While Wired, one of my favourite magazines, describes Bitcoin as an alarming haven for money laundering and other criminal activity. Even the UK's Snowden-friendly Guardian newspaper depicts Bitcoin as a shadow economy that connects students, drug dealers, gamblers, dictators, and anyone else who wants to pay for something without being traced. Count me in. Such comments are typical of the politics that have grown up around Bitcoin. Bitcoin uses a considerable amount of electricity. There's a good story about that, but we don't have time, because I'm in Germany, so I've got to finish on time. And its critics have been fast to point this out. During the Bitcoin boom in April 2013, Bloomberg published a piece calling Bitcoin a real-world environmental disaster, and came up with the measurement that Bitcoin uses up 982 megawatt-hours a day. That's enough to power roughly 31,000 US homes, it said. Paul Krugman joined the chorus, dismissing people who think it's smart, nay, cutting edge, he said, to create a sort of virtual currency whose creation requires wasting real resources. Of course, none of these critics tried to measure the environmental costs associated with the production and use of more conventional money, such as paper bills and plastic credit cards. As with critics of Bitcoin's role in the illegal economy, this was less a serious debate about the merits of Bitcoin than a campaign to discredit the currency. From the perspective of monetary theory, perhaps the most problematic aspect of Bitcoin is its depiction of money as a thing. Arguably, the greatest barrier to Bitcoin's success as money is the hoarding that this image of money encourages. Speculation has focused attention mainly on the value of Bitcoin, suggesting that its rising price against the US dollar is an indicator of its success qua money. This is nonsense, of course. Nothing that experiences this kind of price increase, even without the volatility, is going to work well as money. This mentality underwrites the logic of storing money as if it were an asset, not a medium of exchange. Bitcoin was meant to be a form of money that will not lose its value. It is meant to be inflation-proof. Technically speaking, as a form of money, the danger of Bitcoin, if anything, is not hyperinflation, but hyperdeflation. Little wonder that Bitcoin is loathed by Keynesians. One of the most eloquent statements of the hoarding problem came, of course, from Silvio Gazelle, who argued that money is an instrument of exchange and nothing else, whose sole test of usefulness was the degree of security, rapidity, and cheapness with which goods are exchanged. good money, as Gazell understood it, should secure, accelerate, and cheapen the exchange of goods. By contrast, the introduction of the gold standard to Germany had been a disaster because it had over-improved money, considering it only from the point of view of its holder. Gazell's proposal was disarmingly simple: make money less attractive to hold on to. Money, he argued, should age just like commodities. It must go out of date like a newspaper, rot like potatoes, rust like iron, and evaporate like ether. Bitcoin fits Gazell's description of a form of money that has been over-improved. When it comes to evaluating its potential as money, Bitcoin's digital metallism, its similarity to gold, is a huge disadvantage. In other words, the very feature of Bitcoin that renders it attractive as an open and democratic monetary system that is free from asymmetrical power structures, the software that controls exactly how many Bitcoins will be produced, undermines its operation as a form of money. Reflecting such concerns, a new variant of Bitcoin is under development, which exploits its perceived virtue of disintermediation while specifically seeking to avoid hoarding. This is Freecoin, which is essentially Bitcoin plus Demirage. The new currency is being promoted through the Freecoin Foundation, which is linked to Occupy. As I've been suggesting then, the reality of Bitcoin is somewhat different from the ideology which appears to have fueled interest in the new currency. Let me reiterate the argument in three basic steps. First, the state. Although there is no state in Bitcoin, it is difficult to concur that Bitcoin is an example of horizontalism. In some ways, the Bitcoin community mirrors more conventional financial structures. It has a 1% wealthy, it's organized producers, and it's conceivable that there could be a monopoly on Bitcoin production because there are incentives to scale up. There may be no state, but that would resemble a fiat monetary system in a number of important ways. Likewise, the argument about inflation. If the attraction of Bitcoin is that it conquers volatility and the price of money, it has clearly failed. Although if the attraction is to see the value of money itself steadily increase as if it were an asset, then it is difficult to deny that Bitcoin is a success. But that would make Bitcoin successful as a tool of speculation, not as money. And finally, to trust. To portray Bitcoin as trust-free is clearly wrong. Trust matters to Bitcoin on a number of levels. Bitcoin has clearly placed a great deal of faith in the code. Although this isn't directly trust in another human being, it is trust in technology. It is what Giddens once called disembedded trust. Indeed, it's arguably the sacred, the shared, could say sacred, collective belief in Bitcoin's efficacy as a technology that underpins it. And that sense of collective belief is sustained by the community, the social reality around Bitcoin. Hence, trust between humans matters to Bitcoin too, as we also saw in a more negative sense in the collapse of MT Gox. As sociologists of science and technology have been arguing for a long time, technological artifacts cannot simply enact organizational forms on their own. Human, social, and political factors inevitably emerge as those who interact with these and use these artifacts both shape and are shaped by their practical use. In Bitcoin's case, there was a close analogy between the underlying view of money as a thing in itself and the notion that technology is capable of shaping a social system, in this instance, money, all by itself, free from human intervention. Arguably, it was faith in technological solutions to information problems in the economy that enabled people to believe that credit risk could be managed through securitization. This was blind trust. Collateralized debt obligations, like Bitcoin, were underpinned by trust in numbers that few people who use them actually understood. Bitcoin is exactly the same. The idea behind Bitcoin is premised on denying what I believe is Zimmel's most important insight into the social life of money, by treating money as a thing, not as a process. This idea cannot withstand close scrutiny. What Bitcoin surely does confirm is that it no longer makes sense to talk of money as a claim upon society if, by society, we essentially mean something we belong to. This is a good reason to read Zimmel, because he was careful to avoid such a notion of society from the outset. In his terms, money is a claim, if not on society, then on varying modes of shared existence and experience. So, where does that leave Bitcoin? Bitcoin is currently being sustained by sociological features that are directly at odds with the political ideology and the theory of money that underpin it. These include leadership, social organization, social structure, sociality, utopianism, and trust. None of these necessarily means that it will work as money. Hard-headed analysis suggests that the Bitcoin has far less chance of succeeding as money than the blockchain technology, which will be and is being adapted for other purposes, such as MasterCoin and Ethereum, which are essentially smart contracts. So Bitcoin probably won't exist as a currency in that sense. Hang on, wrong way, sorry. And why might Bitcoin fail? If it ever lived up to its ideology, it would, not least because of the hoarding problem. Other reasons include rivals that either supersede Bitcoin or crowd it out, volatility, monopoly, regulation, loss of trust, and even technical failure. Here then are my conclusions. First, Bitcoin is not an asocial monetary form, but a techno-utopia that is sustained by social practices and which possesses a social structure. Second, Bitcoin's ideology helps to sustain it as a tool or asset, a tool of speculation, while undermining it as a form of money. Third, Bitcoin has served as a focal point for discussion about the future of money, but rests on misleading assumptions about the nature of money, primarily by treating money as a thing rather than as a process. And finally, Bitcoin, particularly the community that's grown up around it, nevertheless underlines money's strong associations with utopianism, challenging classical conceptions of money as antithetical to the good society. For all of Bitcoin's status of the enfant terrible of the world's monetary landscape, Bitcoin rests on a theory of money that is closer to the politics of austerity than to socially progressive monetary reform. Yet in practice, Bitcoin and the debate surrounding it manifests forms of sociality and creativity that are crucial to nature's money as a process. Thank you very much.